Part 7. The Pilgrimage. The master had long admired the great virtue of the venerable Master Shuyin and had wished to journey to Nanhua Monastery in Canton to meet him. In the autumn of 1946, after the surrender of the Japanese, travel once again became possible, and the master set out with his two disciples, Guo Neng and Guo Shun. He left them at Prajna Temple in Changchun, where they received the complete precepts, and he continued alone on his way to Putuo Mountain to receive the precepts there. He carried no possessions whatever, and times were hard. He was often without even the money to buy a glass of water. The master stopped at Tianxin and stayed at the Great Compassion Academy, where he attended Dharma Master Tan Xu's lectures on the Sharangama Sutra. He had wished to meet both masters, Tan Xu and Ding Xi, who was then called Ru Guang. But it's not easy to meet the elder Dharma masters. First, an appointment must be made with the guest prefect, after which one might have to wait for days on end and still never have an interview. Why did the master wish to meet the two Dharma masters? As a matter of principle, the master draws near to all good-knowing advisors. Master Tan Xu was a famous teacher from the Northeast, and the master was at that time only a novice. He waited for several days, but no opportunity arose. Then, on the day when Dharma Master Ding Xi was planning to return to the Northeast, the master rose early in the morning and waited in the courtyard to have a few words with him. When he arrived, the master bowed and introduced himself and said that he was planning to go to Putuo Mountain to receive the precepts. "Don't involve me with your problems," said Ding Xi. "Take them up with the abbot." "I don't pay attention to such matters." Dharma Master Ding Xi thought that the master had come to beg for money, but that certainly was not the case. "You are mistaken," said the master. "I'm not out to beg from you."
"Oh?"
said Dharma Master Ding Xi. "Well then, there's even less of a problem," and he left. The master then met Dharma Master Ti Jing, and together with 12 others, they boarded a boat for Shanghai. In memory of the event which followed, the master has written a verse. It appears with a commentary below. The verse: traveling by boat from Tianxin to Hubei during the autumn of 1946 and almost encountering disaster by shipwreck, a response was received, and so the vomit verse was written. The Sangha, 14 in all, sailed south. Long-bearded elder, Shramanera, green. The azure sea reached the sky. Sky for 10,000 miles. Black waves followed, billowing wave upon wave a thousandfold. The Dharma subdued the monsters. The boat was not capsized. The wheel received the sage's aid, and vomiting was quelled. Happily reaching Huhai, hunger and thirst were dispelled. At Wuzong, right enlightenment, the sound of the jeweled conch. The Sangha, 14 in all, sailed south. Dharma Master Ti Jing led the group of 14 monks. He told them all to hand over their money to him, as that was his policy. The 14 included Bhikshus Jurhai, then called Mo Ru, Ti Jing, Sheng Zhao, Sheng Miao, Yongling, Jingjie, Bunjur, Yingxiu, Jiaojur, Renhui, Jiaoding, Huiru, Yanxiu, and the Master. Four of the group, Sheng Jiao, Sheng Miao, Jingjie, and the Master were young Shramaneras, novices, and so the verse says, Long-bearded elder, Shramanera green. Master Ti Jing had a very long beard. He was also a strict disciplinarian and liked to scold people more than anything else. As soon as he saw someone, he would shut his eyes and bellow, You, la la la! The master also called him a long-bearded elder because in northeast China, they called robbers red beards. And after all, Master Ti Jing did insist that all of their money be turned over to him. The azure sea reached the sky. Sky for 10,000 miles. Black waves followed billowing, wave upon wave, a thousandfold. The sea was calm when they first set out. After a while, however, it turned black, and the waves rose to 50, 60, and 70 feet. The boat, about 300 feet long, was pitched about violently like a toy. All one could do was lie on the deck. It was impossible to stand up. Usually, the crossing was very easy, about 1 week trip. This time it took over 2 weeks because there were thousands of sea monsters stirring up the water in an attempt to drown the master. Why did this happen? You will remember that in northeast China, the master had cured his disciple Guo Zuo of a disease which was a major karmic obstacle, and Guo Zuo had later obtained some spiritual powers. Then, Guo Zuo made an arrogant remark and lost his powers. Shortly after that, his sickness returned, more fierce than before. At that time, it was the master's policy never to rest until he had cured his disciples of their illnesses. After 3 weeks of using the Sharangama mantra, Guo Zuo's demon fled. The master met them again at Dongjing, East Well, when they tried to drown him in a flash flood. You see, curing illnesses often makes the demonic beings so angry that they will stop at nothing in their thirst for revenge. Now the master met them again, and they tried with all of their might to capsize the boat and drown him. They were extremely violent. No one else was aware of the cause of the storm. Everyone got sick. Only Master Ti Jing manifested some spiritual powers by not throwing up. The master vomited bile which burned his lips. He had no strength, no breath, and was on the verge of death. Guanyin Bodhisattva, the master said, If I can be of use in the world, then let me live. If I am of no use in helping living beings, then I'll die. It's no problem. It was at that point that the master truly understood the meaning of the remark he often makes today, that is, everything's okay. He had put his life in the hands of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The wheel received the sage's aid, and vomiting was quelled. As it turned out, there were certain methods, dharmas, the master employed to subdue the sea monsters, and so the boat was not capsized. The wheel might refer to the steamship, literally wheel boat in Chinese, because the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas secretly helped out and prevented the boat from turning over. Or you could say it refers to the master, whose name includes the word wheel. Since the one-week trip had stretched into two and was going on three, the food was rationed, and no one ate his fill. Everyone was hungry. When one of them complained, Master Ti Jing scolded him. "You, la la la," he shouted, "all you do is talk about being hungry." And he pointed at the master and said, "Look at Master Anzi. He only eats one meal a day and he never complains." Master Yong Ling said, "Of course he doesn't. He eats on the sly. He sneaks the rice crust." Why did he say that? One day the cook had given the master a small bit of rice crust, which the master didn't eat, but passed on to the little novice, Sheng Miao. When Master Yong Ling saw the master take the crust, he assumed the master ate it, and he slandered the master to everyone he saw. And so it was that for almost 2 weeks, no one ate his fill. It didn't really matter, however, because regardless of what one ate, it was vomited right back up with bitter stomach fluids. Happily reaching Hu Hai, hunger and thirst dispelled. When the voyage had become totally unbearable, they arrived finally in Shanghai, also called Hu Hai, and Ti Jing said, "Buy noodles." They made more noodles than they could eat, and as they were about to dump the leftovers into the sea, Master Yong Ling said to the master, "Do you want some?" The master thought, "For the last 2 weeks they didn't have enough food, and now they are throwing it away. That's too pitiful." And so he drank two bowls of the water the noodles were cooked in. Master Yong Ling went running to Master Ti Jing. "He claims he doesn't eat," he said, "but when you're not looking, he will eat anything." Long-bearded Ti Jing looked at the master for a long time. "How could you eat the soup?" he said. "You claim not to eat in the morning, and then you steal food." He scolded the master severely, but the master didn't defend himself. At Wuzhang, Right Enlightenment, the sound of the jeweled conch. Wuzhang is Hubei province, and Right Enlightenment is the name of the temple where the master stayed. He slept on a meditation bench by the door without a sleeping bag or blanket, and wore the same clothing day and night. Everyone said, "How come you're not cold?" "Who is cold?" the master answered, pretending to be very stupid. Later, many said, "Ah, your bitter practices are something we could never bear." Long-bearded Ti Jing never did return the master's money, by the way. At Right Enlightenment Temple, the master served as a verger. Although the winters were bitter, he continued to wear only the same three layers of cotton clothing. He sat on a straw mat and watched the door and made great progress in his meditation. The whole time he was there, a rare fragrance filled the hall, a fragrance not of this world. The master had no friends in Hubei. From morning to night, no one paid any attention to him, and many looked down on him as a useless rice monk. Nonetheless, the master was always extremely respectful towards everyone. He practiced austerities, working as the cook, water carrier, and janitor. While cleaning out the pit toilets, the master came to understand that jealousy and laziness are the karmic conditions which lead to rebirth as a dung beetle. Pit toilets stink to high heaven, but the worms that live in them think they are quite comfortable. In 1947, the master again set out for Puto Mountain, the pilgrimage site sacred to Guanyin Bodhisattva, and received the ordination. After he was fully ordained, the master went west to live at Lingyan Monastery near Suzhou. He enrolled in study classes and listened to sutra lectures for 3 months. Then, during a recess period, he returned to Manchuria briefly during the summer. On the way back from Manchuria, he carried on his back a snow-white porcelain image of Amitabha Buddha, which had been and would continue to be an efficacious influence in the master's work for Buddhism. He lived at the Buddha recitation school at Lingyan Monastery for a time before departing for Guangdong Province. While at Lingyan, the master met a man named Wu Jin, who was reputed to be a living arhat. Wu Jin could cure people's illnesses through the use of the Great Compassion Mantra. Unfortunately, his chief interest in performing cures was usually his own fame or profit. Once, when he was on Puto Mountain, this living arhat had displayed great spiritual penetrations to cure illnesses and had caused many people to believe in him. His impressive display of healing was designed to earn him a wide enough reputation so that he would be able to beg 2 boats to transport himself and 500 other monks off the island. The monks also had an ulterior motive in going to Puto Mountain during the ordination platform. They had hoped to pick up offerings by virtue of their presence there, but having been unsuccessful, they find they did not even have enough money to pay boat fare to leave the island. It was at this point that the living arhat, Wu Jin, capitalized on his healing powers as a means of begging their passage. Throughout the region, there were many people who had a great deal of faith in Wu Jin, including officials, monks, nuns, and Buddhists of all sorts. When the master met Wu Jin, however, he saw that although the living arhat was dressed in tattered clothing and had the look of an arhat who had transcended birth and death, he would nevertheless soon die. So he asked him, "Are you a living arhat?" "I don't like people to call me that," replied the monk. "What talent do you have that makes you a living arhat?" asked the master. "I cure people's illnesses," came the reply. "Oh, you cure other people's illnesses. You should cure your own illness. Have you cured your own illness?" asked the master. "What illness do I have?" asked the monk. "You have the disease of seeking for fame, and in the future you will develop the illness of seeking for profit." "You cure other people's illnesses, but no one has cured your disease. Someone ought to cure you. I will be very frank with you. If you continue to cure people's illnesses and to display your spiritual penetrations, you will suffer a downfall. You will surely fall. Perhaps you will create serious offenses. Perhaps you will even return to lay life and no longer be a monk." The living arhat immediately knelt before the master. "What are you doing?" the master wanted to know. "If I am going to suffer a downfall, I beg you to save me when it happens," pleaded the living arhat. If he would just stop curing people's illnesses, he would not suffer a downfall. The master had just made that clear. But when Wu Jin knelt before the master, he did not ask how to avoid the downfall, but rather whether the master would save him once he had fallen. Nonetheless, the master answered without hesitation, "Fine. When you fall, I will save you." the conversation ended there. Years later, in Hong Kong, the master again encountered Wu Jin and kept his word about saving him. How much the more real was this abbot's plea in the case of the master? For the master's vigorous cultivation, profound wisdom, and strict observance of the precepts provided such an outstanding model that any abbot would have been reluctant to permit his departure. In the fall, he went on to Kongqing Mountain to attend a 10-week meditation session and pass the winter. There he met the masters Liao Cheng and Ming Guan. During that period, many cultivators attended the week-long sessions, but only the master and the old-bearded Ming Guan spent the entire 70 days in the Chan Hall. When the others retired to their rooms to sleep, the two cultivators sat through the night. Liao Cheng was the abbot of Kongqing, and occasionally the master talked with him, Ming Guan, and the others. The master's banter left them all speechless. Old Chan Sitter, the master once inquired of an old-timer in the politest of tones, "Superior one," he continued with utmost courtesy before demanding abruptly, "How come you can't sit?" "I'm too old," came the defensive reply. "My legs are stiff, my back is bent, and my teeth hurt. I can't do it anymore. I'm not as young as I used to be." "Your teeth hurt?" said the master. "How is it that teeth can hurt? Think it over. Is it your teeth which hurt, or is it you who hurt? If it is your teeth which hurt, they can't talk. How can you speak for them? If it is you who hurt, why do you say it is your teeth?" The cultivator was dumbfounded. He didn't know if his teeth hurt or if he himself hurt. The master was so skilled at delivering such verbal blows and in enduring the rigors of the repeated chant sessions that many claimed the master had been enlightened during the 10-week session at Kongqing. In fact, later, when the master was in Hong Kong, Liao Cheng went to Canton Province to beg and use the light of the master's reputation to drum up business. "The venerable master became enlightened at my temple, you know," he would say, "and I certified him." Blatantly claiming to be the master's good-knowing advisor, he implied that he himself was enlightened and could certify an enlightenment. There are all kinds of people in this world. In the first month of the Chinese New Year, 1948, the master returned to Shanghai, preparing to take a boat for Hangzhou. At Guanyin Gucha in Shanghai, the master met Dharma Master Ru Lian. Ru Lian looked the master up and down and said, "You're a new preceptee. According to the rules, we can't allow you to stay here." "I may be a new preceptee," said the master, "but where did all you old preceptees come from?" "All right," said Ru Lian, "you can stay." The next day they had a chat. The master had written a lot of poetry, and he showed his poems to Master Ru Lian, who sighed in praise. "Ah, these poems," he said. Then he advised the master to give up writing poetry. "If you are attached to the marks of language," he said, "you cannot obtain liberation." "But has the High Master obtained liberation?" the master asked. "No, but I intend to go ahead and practice the way," he answered. "Right," said the master, and he stopped writing poems. Later, when the master announced that he was leaving, Master Ru Lian said, "Please stay for a few more days." "No," said the master, "I really can't. I'm a new preceptee, and you are all old preceptees." In Shanghai, the master boarded a boat for Hangzhou on his way to Canton, by way of Bao Tong Monastery in Hubei. The steamship gave free passage to members of the Sangha, as they lent an auspicious air to the journey. There were rarely storms or other difficulties when Sangha members were on board. On board, the master saw a cripple, and the moment he saw him, he knew that he could cure his illness. He also knew it would cause a lot of trouble if he cured it right away. And so the master ignored the matter for the time being. On the morning of the day the boat was due to dock in Wujiang, the cripple passed by while the master was meditating on deck. "Why can't you walk?" the master asked him. "I used to sell coal on the black market until the government caught me and put me in jail," the man answered. "The jail was very damp, and I had no room to move around. By the time I was released, I could no longer walk." "Do you want to get well?" asked the master. "Of course I want to get well," was the reply. "If you want to get well," said the master, "you should pitch your crutch over the side of the boat." "But if I do that, I won't be able to walk," said the cripple. "I told you I was going to cure you," said the master. "What are you afraid of?"
"Really?"
the cripple asked. "Try it out and see." The cripple threw his crutch over the side, and the master began to rub his legs. After about 20 minutes, the master said, "Stand up." The cripple stood up. "Walk," said the master. And the cripple began to walk around the deck.
"Run,"
said the master. And the cripple began to run. When people saw him running, they were immediately curious.
"How did you get well?" they asked.
"That old cultivator over there rubbed me with his hands, and now I am well," he said. All of a sudden, everyone on board was sick.
"My head aches," said one.
"My back hurts," cried another. In no time, 40 or 50 people had crowded around the master.
"You all deserve a beating," he said, and he reached out to punch one man on the arm. "Any pain now?" he asked.
"Hey, it doesn't hurt anymore," cried the man. The master reached out and kicked the next fellow.
"Does your leg still hurt?" he asked.
"No, it doesn't hurt now."
"Really?
Or are you lying?" pressed the master.
"Really, it doesn't hurt," said the man.
"You're not deceiving people, are you?" asked the master.
"Of course not," said the man.
Soon, when they were all beaten into health, they began to make offerings. One gave $50,000 Chinese. Another gave $30,000. Another gave $20,000. And another $10,000. Another gave $100,000. And finally, the grand total came to $700,000. A train ticket from Hubei to Guangdong cost $200,000 at the time. Then the people on the boat began to make arrangements.
"I have a cousin who has been sick for years. Won't you please come to my house when we arrive in Wujiang and cure her?"
Another came with a tale of his sick relative, and another, and another, and another. Soon several were setting up appointments to transport the master to their homes to cure their families. All the master would reply was, "Wait until we dock, and then we'll see." When the boat docked, everyone was intent upon gathering their things and disembarking, and those who had asked the master to come to their homes were not paying attention when he slipped off another gangplank and left. One man managed to catch up with him in a car and kept shouting out the window,
"Hey, please come to my house."
But the master replied, "I haven't time now. Wait until the next time."
Then he lost himself in the crowd, and the man couldn't find him. The master stayed the night on the floor in a temple in Wuzhong. The next day he went to Heng Mountain to Bao Tong Monastery to stay the night. But his fame had already spread. People approached him and said, "Yesterday several members of the Sangha arrived and they told how you cured illnesses on the boat. I also have a problem. Could you help me?"
"Wait until tomorrow and then we'll see," replied the master. He then slipped out at the crack of dawn for the train station. There, he met another member of the Sangha and asked him, "Where are you headed, old Bodhisattva?"
"I'm going to Guangdong," the monk replied in a high-pitched nasal, which distinguished him immediately as a native of Hubei.
"What are you going to do in Guangdong?" asked the master.
"I'm going to see Xu Lao,
the venerable elder Master Xu Yun." This was exactly the master's intent. "Have you got money to buy a train ticket?" the master asked.
"No,"
said the monk emphatically. He thought the master was trying to beg a ticket from him.
"I'll buy you one then," said the master. "How's that?"
The monk was delighted. The two tickets cost $400,000. On the train, the master had his usual one meal of the day, but the other monk wanted to eat often. Every time they stopped in a station, the master noticed that the monk looked famished, and he gave him money for food. When they arrived in Ma Ba, Guangdong, the location of Nanhua Monastery, the master still had some $300,000 left. In the train station, the monk wanted rice gruel, which cost several thousand dollars per bowl. So the master took out the entire $300,000 and gave it to the monk, leaving himself in total poverty once again.
"You're giving it all to me?" the monk asked.
"It's all yours," replied the master, and with that, the monk seemed dissatisfied. So the master arrived at Nanhua without a penny, and remained that way for some time.
Mind-to-mind seal. Arriving in Guangdong early in 1948, after 3,000 miles of travel, the master went to Nanhua Monastery and bowed before the Venerable Master Xu Yun, the 44th patriarch from Shakyamuni Buddha. At that first meeting, the Venerable Master Yun, who was then 109 years old, recognized the master to be a vessel worthy of the Dharma and capable of its propagation. He sealed and certified the master's spiritual skill and transmitted to him the wonderful mind-to-mind seal of all Buddhas. Thus, the master became the 45th generation in a line descending from Shakyamuni Buddha, the 19th generation in China from Bodhidharma, and the 9th generation of the Weiyan lineage. Of their meeting, the master has written, "The noble Yun saw me and said, 'Thus it is.' I saw the noble Yun and verified, 'Thus it is.' The noble Yun and I both thus universally vow that all living beings will also be thus." The mind-to-mind transmission is performed apart from the mark of the spoken word, apart from the mark of the written word, apart from the mark of the conditioned mind, apart from all such characteristics. Only sages who have a genuine realization understand it. Common people have no idea what is happening. It is a mutual recognition of the embodiment of the principle of the true suchness. After the mind-to-mind seal was transmitted
At the two masters' first meeting in 1948, the younger master stayed on at Nanhua, drawing near to the elder master Yun, who appointed him Bansho, head of the assembly, and assigned him to the Nanhua Vinaya Academy as an instructor. The elder master later went to Yunmen in Ruyuan County, Guangdong Province, where he was also abbot of Dajiao Monastery. After the elder master's departure, the master accepted an invitation to lecture the Amitabha Sutra in Nanjiang, Jiangxi Province. During the course of the master's lectures, two sick people miraculously recovered. After the lecture series, the master returned to Nanhua. The following month, a band of thieves forced their way into the monastery, intent upon looting it. The thieves arrived one evening and began beating on the main door and shouting that they were government representatives intent upon military business. The master refused to open the door. At that sound, others in the monastery ran for cover, including two of the master's young disciples who hid under the nearest bed. The master stood alone and finally opened the door to the thieves. They entered swinging clubs and brandishing guns. Threatening the master, they shouted, "Why didn't you open the door?" "You are a band of thieves," was the master's reply. "You've come to take, not to give. What do you think? If you were me, would you have opened the door?" They aimed their guns at the master, but he coolly stood his ground. "Give us your money," they shouted. The master, dressed in his rag robes, said simply, "Look at this robe. Do I look like a rich man?" "No," they admitted, but glanced around. They added, "But your students must have money." "If the teacher is penniless, surely the disciples will be even poorer," pointed out the master. Determined to see for themselves, the thieves searched the monastery. The master followed right on their heels, scolding and taunting them the whole time. "Now don't steal anything," he warned. And eventually the bandits left empty-handed. The master's courage and conviction quelled the fears of the Vinaya Academy students and kept them from abandoning their studies and leaving the monastery as a result of the incident. Consequently, the master was asked to become head of the Vinaya Academy, a position he accepted until the end of 1948, at which time he resigned the post and spent the ensuing months reading the Lungzong edition of the Chinese Tripitaka. During the 1949 transmission of the precepts at Nanhua Monastery, the Venerable Shuyin presided as precepts transmitter, and the master was one of the seven acharyas who certified the transmission. After the ceremonies, the master accompanied the Venerable Yun as far north as Xiaoguan. The Venerable Yun continued on to Yunmen, and the master returned to Nanhua. Later, the master traveled alone to Yunmen to join the elder master at Dajiao Monastery. Traveling alone on the mountainous path, the master was easy prey for wild beasts and harmful creatures. But he felt no fear, and as a result, he was not molested. About 8 miles from Yunmen, night suddenly fell, and the master found it difficult to make progress in the darkness along the unfamiliar path. Suddenly, a lamplight appeared before him, and he followed it. After he had walked scarcely 100 paces, the light disappeared, and when the master peered around to regain his bearings, he saw that he had arrived at the very gate of Dajiao Monastery. After he entered and paid his respects to the Venerable Master Yun, the elder master questioned him about his late arrival, surprised that he had been able to find his way on the dangerous mountain path. "It is difficult enough to travel alone on these roads in broad daylight without losing the way. How remarkable that you have been able to do so in the pitch black of night! Very strange," commented the elder Yun. The elder master then instructed the master to take the position of Bansho, head of the assembly, at Yunmen, just as he had at Nanhua. The master assumed the duties but soon decided to return south to Guangdong. The venerable master was very reluctant to give his permission. "Don't go," he advised. "If you do, it will be difficult to return." But the master was not to be persuaded to remain. "No," he said, "your disciple has already made up his mind. He is definitely going." Hearing his student's words, the elder Master Yun was grieved to the point of tears. He reached out and, taking the master's hand, told him plainly, "If you go, you won't be able to come back." The master passed the words off lightly and urged the elder Yun not to worry about him. "When the time comes, I will return," he said confidently. Since it was clear that his disciple was determined to leave, the Venerable Yun advised him, "On your journey, you should make every effort to speak in the name of Shakyamuni Buddha and establish way places to carry on the work of the patriarchs of the past. There is limitless light on the road ahead. Push on, work hard, conduct yourself well, and don't forget that I am waiting. Take care. Goodbye." No return. When the master left Yunmen in the summer of 1949, he went directly to Hong Kong, but soon returned to Canton because he intended to keep his word and return to Yunmen. In Canton, he went to Liurong Monastery, where the abbot was Ming Guang, an old monk with a long beard. Upon his arrival, the abbot asked the master to be Bansho. Since the master planned to return to Yunmen on October 6th, the 15th of the 8th lunar month, a month after his arrival at Liurong Monastery, he agreed to serve for the duration of his visit. But before 2 weeks had passed, the road to Yunmen was cut off at Xiaoguan due to the fighting, making it impossible for the master to return to Yunmen. He stayed on at Liurong. At that time, the monastery had 500 ounces of gold in its treasury, as well as some 3,000 silver dollars, equivalent to $50,000 U.S. at the current rate of exchange. After Xiaoguan fell, the master advised Abbot Ming Guan, "I suggest three alternative plans, any one of which will help you. The first is to take all the money at Liurong Monastery and divide it among the 30-some monks in residence here. Count me out. I don't want any of it." After the money is divided, the monks may go or stay as they wish, but if they stay, make them pay their own way. Don't keep any community funds. The second is to take all the money to Hong Kong and deposit it in a Hong Kong bank. It's useless to leave it here. Xiaoguang is already occupied and Canton will be next. If you put it in a Hong Kong bank, then in the future when you go to Hong Kong, you can use it. The third is to take the money to Hong Kong, buy a piece of land and build a monastery on it, then move all the monks from Liurong to the new monastery, and you can maintain your position as abbot.
Whichever of these three plans you use will be beneficial. But the abbot would not hear any of it. In fact, the very idea of carrying out such plans scared him out of his wits, and he stood before the master shaking and crying. "The cause and effect is too severe. I don't dare move that money. I'm not qualified." On the morning of the 18th, the master decided not to attend morning recitation. His position as head of the assembly granted him the right to miss the daily ceremonies, but he had never exercised the privilege before. Perhaps his absence from the hall influenced the others, or perhaps it was the general state of unrest and tension, but it so happened that on that morning, none of the monks went into the hall for morning recitation. When the abbot came in, he found himself alone. Infuriated, he marched down the hall past the master's door, chanting, "He borrows others' incense and flowers to cultivate his own blessings and honor. How is it that in the morning he doesn't even enter the hall? What ghost has he got?" His intention was to heckle the master, but when the master heard the taunt, he simply decided to leave. Once again, the abbot was penniless and unable to buy a ticket to Hong Kong. However, he went to the train station anyway and soon encountered a layman named Cheng Quan Man, who said to the master, "I'm going to Hong Kong today." And when he learned that the master had the same intention, he offered to buy the master's ticket for the trip. Once the ticket was purchased, the master returned to Liu Rung Monastery to say goodbye to the abbot. "I'm going, Elder Abbot," he said. "Goodbye." "Don't go," fretted the abbot. "How can you go? If we die together." "You die together." "I'm not going to. You may be old enough to die, but I haven't reached that point yet. Besides, what are you worried about? You've still got your beard," said the master, and he departed. The abbot sent Ru Xiu, his attendant, after the master with $10. "Take this and give it to him," he instructed. But when Ru Xiu pressed the money into the master's hand, the master wadded it up and threw it on the ground. "That's stinking stuff," he said. "How can you hand me such vile-smelling filth?" This was the master's final departure from the mainland. 3 days later, Canton fell. The old abbot and the monks stuffed their gold and silver in trunks and suitcases and headed for the train station. But once on board, everything was confiscated. Later, when Ming Guang encountered the master in Hong Kong, he whined, "If only I had listened to you." To which the master replied, "Tell me, old monk, do you think you made a mistake in cause and effect or not? But what are you worried about? You've still got your beard." Cultivation in Guanyin Cave. The master went directly from Hong Kong to Thailand, where he examined the southern transmission of the Buddha Dharma. After several months in Thailand, the master returned to Hong Kong. Once again, he arrived penniless. Shortly after his arrival, he met Upasaka, layman, Guo Guan Pu, who knew of a cave on Fu Rung Mountain above Hong Kong where the master might continue to cultivate the way. The layman led the master to the cave, a small, dark hole in the face of the mountainside. Bending low to enter the mouth of the cave, the master found a flat rock inside. He sat down on it and pulled his legs up into lotus position. He had no furniture or utensils, no bedding or food, and had only his tattered, patched robe to wear. The master sat unmoving on the rock in the barren cave for several days and nights, only deciding to get up after about 100 hours of uninterrupted sitting. But when he tried to stand, he found that his legs wouldn't move. Rather than giving in to an instinctive reaction of panic and concern for the welfare of his body, the master paid no attention to the paralysis, but simply continued to sit on the rock in the dank cave. He remained in the full lotus meditation posture day and night for 2 full weeks, and then gradually began to recover the use of his legs. Once the master could walk again, he went partway down the mountain to Julin Yuan Temple every day to get a little food to help sustain his cultivation. Other than that, he remained in seclusion. As the turmoil on the mainland increased, Sangha members were among the refugees who began to pour into Hong Kong. Most of them had abandoned their monasteries along with their sutras, Dharma instruments, images, stupas, money, valuables, offerings, and clothing. They arrived in Hong Kong empty-handed. Since the refugees needed help in finding food, clothing, and shelter, the master relaxed his seclusion, and responding to the external conditions, he left his cave whenever necessary to assist his Dharma brothers. It was during this period that the master wrote a letter to the Venerable Master Lai Guo, who had remained on the mainland in his post of abbot of Gaomin Monastery near Yangzhou. The master's letter read, "Elder Master Lai Guo, compassionate one, take care of the Buddha Dharma as it is embodied in your wisdom life. I have the deepest regard for the Dharma as it is embodied in your life, and now the times are extremely dangerous for the Dharma. It is my deep wish that not even one of your hairs is harmed. May you protect the Dharma just that carefully." The second patriarch cut off his arm in quest of the Dharma. The sixth patriarch protected the Dharma by living secretly among hunters for 16 years. "I would be relieved if you would follow their examples and come to Hong Kong, not out of fear, but to protect the Dharma and save living beings. Wait for the right time. Now please rest in the way. Anzi bows with respect." Shortly afterward, the master received a reply. "Great Master Anzi, use the light of your wisdom to regard these words. Yesterday I respectfully received your letter. When the great Dharma is completely uplifted, how can it be discriminated into regions? When men's lifespan is 10 years, I intend to come to this world to once again raise up the Dharma's monastic pillar. Shakyamuni's sons and grandsons practice only true conduct. No confrontation will be avoided. Please put your heart at ease. I again send my regards. Now please rest in the way." Written by Lai Guo's hand. Despite his seclusion in Guanyin Cave, word of the master's cultivation spread, and many people came to seek his compassionate aid. One case was that of a niece of John Sui Zhang, a prominent Hong Kong merchant, and his wife. Their niece, John Jian Kai, had been orphaned in infancy, and they raised her as a daughter. When the girl became of age, her aunt and uncle found a suitable husband for her in a Mr. Poon, whose family was located in Kowloon. Shortly after their marriage, however, the husband suddenly died. Everyone was shocked by the loss. The young bride was deeply grieved, and a demonic ghost took advantage of her melancholy and possessed her. She became delirious and took to babbling incoherently.
Mr. and Mrs. Zhang were aware that their niece's sickness was caused by demonic possession, and they felt very sorry for her. Hoping to drive the ghost out and bringing an end to the girl's severe depression, they invited several members of the Sangha to their home to recite sutras and mantras. Among the bhikshus chosen were seven whom the master had recently helped become established in Hong Kong. They arrived at the merchant's home dressed in formal dark robes and sashes, and proceeded to spend an entire week in the living room of the rich man's home, alternately reciting the Vajra Sutra and the Great Compassion Mantra in an attempt to exorcise the ghost. Throughout the entire recitation, however, the ghost lay in the bed in the adjacent room chanting along with them. Whenever the bhikshus recited, the ghost would recite. This counter-recitation totally nullified the efficacy of the Dharma Master's attempt to free the girl. The running battle between the ghost and the Dharma Masters continued until finally one of the bhikshus, Dharma Master Hung Ye, said, "If we want to cure this girl, we will have to get Dharma Master Dulin. He can subdue anything." So saying, Hung Ye took it upon himself to go to see the master. He climbed the mountain to Guanyin Cave and knelt before the master, who, as usual, was seated in meditation on the flat rock. Hung Ye begged the master to come and free the girl, but the master made no reply. Hung Ye eventually left the cave and returned to the merchant's house alone. As soon as he entered the house, he heard the mocking chant of the ghost continuing to thwart the bhikshu's efforts. Frustrated, he turned around and went back up the mountain to ask for help once more. He entered the cave, knelt, and repeated his request, but once again was met with silence, as the master made no reply. Once again, Hung Ye returned to the merchant's household alone. Upon his return, John Sui Zhang approached Hung Ye and asked about the outcome of his visit. "The master is in seclusion and has chosen to ignore worldly matters for the time being," replied Hung Ye. "I have gone twice to request his help, but to no avail." Having heard Hung Ye's original declaration that the master could subdue anything, and realizing that the chanting of the gathering of eminent Sangha members was proving to be ineffectual, the merchant decided to make a personal plea to the master. He climbed the mountain, entered the small dark cave, made obeisance to the master, and stated his request with dignity and propriety. "If a whole group of Sangha members has been reciting sutras and mantras, and their strength has not been sufficient to subdue the ghost, obviously the strength of just one person would be inadequate," reasoned the master, and once again refused the request. Upasaka John remained kneeling before the master for some time and made clear his sincere concern for the welfare of the girl, expressing his faith that the master could help her. After a long while, the master was moved by his sincerity and agreed to go to the merchant's home. In contrast to the gathering of Sangha members in the living room, dressed in full formal attire and surrounded with Dharma implements, instruments, images, incense, and the like, the master made no display of finery or ceremony. He arrived at the Zhang residence dressed in his rag robe and quietly took a chair in the room with the ghost near the girl's bed. He sat in silence. He did not recite any sutras or mantras aloud. He just sat there. After about half an hour, the sick girl got up and knelt before the master.
The master took off his string of prayer beads and slipped them over the girl's neck. "Here, take hold of the beads," he suggested softly to her. As soon as Zhang Jiankai took hold of the beads, the ghost who was possessing her began to scream, "Stop! Stop! They're burning me alive! I'm burning to death! I'll take refuge! Please, let me take refuge! Let me become a disciple!" The ghost, acting through the girl, was in a frenzy trying to rid himself of the beads. "What makes you decide to take refuge with me now?" asked the master as he reached out and removed the beads from the girl's neck. "Why didn't you take refuge last week with the Dharma masters who have been reciting sutras and mantras here?" "Them?" scoffed the ghost. "Why, I wouldn't even let them take refuge with me. How much the less would I take refuge with them?" "Why is that?" asked the master. "Ask them," said the ghost. "They must know." "What prompted your sudden decision to reform your evil ways?" "I was being burned alive, I tell you. As soon as your beads got near me, they burned hotter than fire. I couldn't stand it." "That's funny," replied the master as he placed the beads around his own neck. "They don't hurt me." Then he instructed the ghost, "If you want to take refuge with a triple jewel, you will have to reform completely. From now on, you can't cause people any distress or difficulty. Do you understand?" After receiving the instruction, the ghost agreed to behave and humbly departed. When the merchant's family saw that only a half hour after the master had entered the house, the girl had returned to normal, they all bowed before him as their teacher. After that, every year, the family requested the master to write the New Year's greetings for them. He selected words of Dharma and wrote them out in his calligraphy. Since the master began that practice, the family's business thrived, with the exception of one year, when the son of John Sui Zhang persuaded his father not to bother having the master write the greetings. That year, business fell off considerably. Even to this day, every year the family sends slips of paper by registered mail to America and requests the master to write out their New Year's greetings.